Alright, David, Brandon, Ryan, Chad, Ernest, Josh, Cam, Tyler. I think she might be dead. Brandon, Trevor. Alright. World War I. War to end all wars. War unlike anything the world had ever seen before. And thankfully, it is a war unlike there has been since. The Western Front, as we saw, was a static war. A war of trenches. A war of fixed positions. Because the only way for the soldiers to survive the machine guns and the artillery and, well, let's just say the outright fields of death were for them to dig down into trenches in the ground. Because human bodies do not do well when chunks of lead coming at you at subsonic speed hits you because you have a tendency to go splat. So, what do? You get your shovels out. You dig a trench, you use sandbags, you use barbed wire to keep the enemy away, and you basically fight from the protected points. But of course, you can't win a war if you're only on defense. So what do they continue to do for 4 years? Well, let's do the over-the-top charge, and let's go run at the enemy trenches. The only problem is once you get there, they're going to move troops around and counter, and they're going to drive you back, only resulting in death. So what do you try doing? You try inventing more lethal forms of technology, more efficient ways of killing people, which of course is countered by the enemy with other more efficient ways of killing people. Death, death, death. Of course, the classic example that we saw was the Battle of Verdun. The longest, most destructive battles of all the battles. And interestingly enough, that battle was so destructive that of the 12 villages that were around the fort of Verdun, 10 of them still are unoccupied to this day. Because there literally are millions of shells and mines that litter the ground, making it uninhabitable. Well, on the Eastern Front, this side, things were different. Things were very different. The reason being, the scope. The Western Front was only about 400 miles. The Eastern Front was 1,000 plus miles. And as a result, because it was so wide of terrain, trenches never developed. Because you did not have enough men to guard every single inch of the line. So what you would do is you would have army units that would advance or retreat. But there would be gaps in between. On the east, you had Germany. You had the Austro-Hungarian Empire. You had the Ottomans. You'd have the Bulgarians fighting against the Russians. And for about 2 months, the Romanians. I didn't realize I double-clicked. Another problem was it was next to impossible to communicate. On the Western Front, because of all the trenches, you were able to lay down telephone lines or telegraph lines or have runners that could go from point to point to point. In the East, there was nothing. Just fields and woods as far as the eye could see. There also were a few urban centers here. So, it was next to impossible to reposition your army. So in my World War I class, we literally talked about some battles where the Russian army was trying to advance. They didn't know that the Germans were there and accidentally marched right into them. And the Germans weren't aware that they were coming. Well, one of the most glaring instances of the Eastern Front, or facts, is the fact that Russia was still not prepared to fight. Now, one of the most amazing things is that when the war began in 1914, Russia did have the largest standing army. They had 1.4 million men that were in their armed services. Plus, they were able to mobilize another 5 million. This large, vast military force. 6.5 million men. But here's the funny thing. They only had 4.5 million rifles. Which meant basically one third of their men went into battle without guns. To make matters worse, they did not have standard issue rifles. They didn't just have one type. Any of you shoot? None of you shoot? Here's the thing. Each gun takes its special type of bullet. Now, some guns are milled to use similar rounds. But if you want to have an AK-47 and an AR-15 and you only have one bullet, it's not going to work in both. You have to have 7.6239 for the AK-47, and you have to have a 5.56 for the AR. Different size cartridges. So now Russia, they had 4.6 million guns, but there were 20 different types of rifles. And some of the rifles dated back to the American Civil War. So this meant, essentially, every single unit had to have different types of ammunition. But they had no factories. So the ammunition they had to get was bought. And as the war progressed, they started literally running out of bullets. Because their allies, France, were on the other side of Germany. So, how did the men fight? Well, they literally used what military experts in the day referred to as the steamroller. So they would take their army, they would see where the enemy was, and they'd just charge at them. The soldiers may have been given a rifle. They may have been given a few bullets. And they were basically told, when the buddy, the guy next to you dies, and you only have bullets, pick up their gun. Or if the guy on the other side has the bullets and you have the gun, well, when he died, then you can get your bullets. In every battle in which the Russians engaged in, they had the highest death counts. Why? Well, they had the worst leadership out of any of the belligerents. Russia was ruled by the Tsar, Nicholas II, who had no military training. He never went to a military academy. He just happened to be born the son of the Tsar. So when he became Tsar, he was the commander-in-chief because he was born into it. So he had no training. And guess what? All of the officers, they were all nobles too. They were all born. And because of the way where they were born, what family they were in, they got the rank. They had little to no training. So if the officers don't know how to lead the men into battle, that's the reason why they actually had men charge with empty guns, clubs, spears, thinking that they could overrun the Germans. But the problem is when you get those Maxim machine guns, 600 to 800 rounds per minute, the men start falling like dominoes. Oh, one other thing. Because the officers were nobles and the soldiers were peasants, they had nothing but contempt for their own men. So if a general started a battle and 50,000 of his men were killed, he didn't care. And, as if that was not bad enough, one of the weirdest coincidences is it was the Russians who invented what's known as the triage system. Any of you know what the military triage system is? Any nursing majors?
I'm a nursing major, but I'm assuming it has to do with the most three important things, like concerning the subject?
No.
Okay.
Good guess. Now, triage is a system of treating wounded on the battlefield. So you set different degrees of injury. So if somebody basically has a cut, you know, you have someone there that gives them a bandage and sends them back to the front. If someone suffers a more significant injury but they can save their life, you know, they're going to go to a surgeon. If somebody suffers a catastrophic injury that you may not be able to save their lives, then you leave them to die.
Well, even though Russia invented the system, they didn't have enough staffing to even run the triage system. They had one surgeon for every 10,000 wounded men.
The most common practice, if someone got injured, was the same medical techniques that were used in the U.S. Civil War. You got a bullet in your arm, well, out comes the saw. Add to this the steamroller. Just charge the enemy. And maybe they'll run out of bullets before you run out of men. Well, it was only a matter of time before the soldiers themselves started realizing that this is stupid. They were able to inspire the men at the beginning of the war by saying, "You're going to go fight for Mother Russia." But by 1916, and the dead begin piling up in the millions, even the Russian soldiers themselves began questioning the insanity of this. But there was no desire to change. So, the longer the war went on, the more slaughter. And eventually it would lead to the collapse of the Russian system itself. I mean, all these guys... All these guys, all of these bodies, as far as the eye can see, all of these mounds are bodies. They lay where they died. You could walk on the backs of the dead men to get across the battlefield. That's outright insanity. In 1916 alone, 1 year, 2 million casualties. And as a result, Russia would find itself in an awful, wicked catch-22. The soldiers were the peasants.
The peasant population was about one-third of all able-bodied men in Russia. So by fielding these vast, large armies, they literally are taking the peasants who are responsible for growing food away from the fields and sending them to the battlefields to die. So, the workers go to the front. Food production begins to go down. Prices go through the roof. And as day turns to week, turns to month, turns to year, even food supplies began to diminish, which results in starvation. Ironically, instead of ending the war, this made the Tsar's government more committed to staying in the war. Because it got so bad that the only way that they could recover was through spoils of war. You know, when the winner wins the war, they're able to take stuff from the losers. So more men, trainful after trainful, sent to the front to die. And how much death? About, give or take, 16 million casualties. Now, not all casualties are death. Casualties include wounded as well. But in total, on the Eastern Front, the Central Powers combined, so Germany, Austria, and the Ottoman Empire, they lost about 6 million, suffered 6 million casualties. And Russia alone suffered 10 million, plus another 2 million civilians. That's twice the population of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. FYI. Actually, that might be the total. That's probably even more than the total of all of New England combined. But think about that. Every human being, men, women, and child, from Maine to Connecticut, with a bullet hole in them. Dead bodies, as far as the eye can see. Well, unfortunately for the Tsar, it would be the death toll and the catch-22 that ultimately would result in a monumental event that took place literally in the midst of one of the worst wars in human history, the Russian Revolution. Question. Now, the Russian Revolution, interestingly enough, was an event that was avoidable, but at the trajectory they were going in, it was inevitable. So they could have stopped it, but by 1916, the train was already running, and it was next to impossible to derail. The reason being was Russia was messed up. Russia had problems. Russia was long reviewed by contemporaries as being akin to a volcano. Meaning, like a volcano, all of the pressure underground begins to boil, and steam and heat and pressure begins to build and build and build up to the point when the top explodes. The biggest problem that Russia had was that it was a supranationalist empire. It was like the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It was a nation, an empire, where one minority group used police powers, dictatorial authority, to control multiple groups of minorities. In terms of the population, only about 45% of what we would call Russian in the Russian Empire. There were Muslims, there were Mongoloids, there were race after race after race, you can imagine. Something like 25 languages were spoke. I think there were 16 religions that were worshipped. You did not have a situation with a majority and a minority. No, everyone was minorities. Plus, it was poor. 86% of the population were peasants. They had nothing. Sometimes nothing more than the shirt on their backs. They had few urban centers, few cities. They had little to no industry, and there was no opportunity for economic mobility. To make matters worse, nationalism took hold. The ethnic minorities, beginning in around 1850, 1860, they all began demanding their independence. They wanted their own country. They wanted freedom. But how did the czars respond? Police state. FYI, their police were their soldiers. So there were no popos driving down the road, you know, with the blues on going, "Wee!" No, if the czar thought you were committing a crime, the soldiers went out and they shot you. There were no trials, no due process, no jury of your peers. Now, ironically, just a decade before, there was another revolution that should have woken Tsar Nicholas II up. But sadly, it did not. In 1905, during the middle of the Russo-Japanese War, a spontaneous event occurred known in Russia as Bloody Sunday. Although today modern historians refer to it as the 1905 Revolution. This took place because of the social structure in Russia. In St. Petersburg, the capital, Petrograd, as it's called in Russian, there were a few factories. Well, the majority of the people that lived in the city were Eastern Orthodox, and a bunch of factory workers didn't like the fact that they had to work 7 days a week. Full days Monday to Saturday, and a half day on Sunday. They were allowed to go to church, but once church was over, they had to go back to the factories. So on a cold November morning, a bunch of factory workers peacefully gathered outside the palace of the Tsar to ask the Tsar to give them Sundays off. They didn't ask for any less hours. They would have worked longer hours the rest of the week. But after all, even God himself, after creating the earth and all life on it, had a day's rest. But there was a problem. When the people went outside the gates, the Tsar wasn't home. The Tsar was away on a hunting trip. But the Tsarina, the Tsar's wife, and the Tsar's four daughters and his son were there. So the palace guards thought that the royal family's life was in danger. So guess what they did to the protesters? Shot them. Now, after this event, the Tsar had an opportunity to change things, but all he did was increase the police state. This is one of the reasons why in 1914 he had 1.4 million men under arms, because he kept building the standing army to use it to force everyone to obey. And that was just one instance. There were other problems that helped get things boiling under the surface. We talked about all the humiliations, right? All of the bad things that happened in Russia. How Austria outmaneuvered Russia over and over again. Going back to the Treaty of Berlin, 1878, when somehow Austria was able to take possession of Bosnia and Herzegovina, and Russia got screwed. Or the annexation crisis, when Russia said to Austria, just absorb Bosnia and Herzegovina, and we'll take the Turkish Straits. Austria got what it wanted. Not Russia. Or how many times did Serbia ask Russia to help him out? And Russia said no. Embarrassment after embarrassment after embarrassment after embarrassment. Oh, and then add in the Russo-Japanese War. Tsar Nicholas II was a racist, 19th century racist. He believed that his ethnic group, the Rus, were ethnically superior than the Japanese. But the Japanese, we know, we saw, knocked out two navies and killed hundreds of thousands of Russian soldiers. Another factor, Russia was backwards. 3% of the population, 3%, controlled 95% of wealth and power in Russia. 3% controlled 95%. And all of that power came as a result of birth. So if you were born a peasant, you had no chance of changing your lifestyle. You were born a peasant, you die a peasant. But the nobles, they could be incompetent buffoons. But because they were born in the right family, they received God's gift. And then lastly, or second to the last, we've already mentioned this, they should not have joined the war, they weren't ready to fight, and this. The catch-22. The more they fought, the more the people necessary for food production died, which meant less food and more starvation. Pardon my language, but this fits what one of my buddies would accurately label as a shit show. If it was just one problem, the Tsar's regime possibly could have maintained control. But problem after problem after problem after problem, and it was just a matter of time. Questions? So what began to happen was not a sudden explosion, but rather, by 1916, conditions on the home front began to deteriorate. Families were losing their sons. Families were losing their fathers with no end in sight and nothing to show for it. There was no food. Money became worthless, and there was hunger. Now, if you're going to win a war, you have to be able to give something. So, classic example. Beginning in the early 1960s, we got sucked into a mess that was created by the French in Vietnam. Lyndon Baines Johnson was completely committed to preserving the independence of South Vietnam. So as a result, he kept sending wave after wave after wave of American GI over to Southeast Asia, and a lot of them were coming back on body bags. Things got so bad in 1968, LBJ decided he was not going to run for re-election, which of course would pave the way for the victory of Richard Nixon. Nixon came in and he realized you're not going to be able to win the war. So what he's going to need to do is he needed to pound North Vietnam so much that they would be willing to go to the negotiation table. Well, at the same time, all of the hippies were out protesting. Make peace, not war. Dancing around in their little hippie clothes. Being all hopped up on LSD. Although they did have really good music. I'll give them that much. America turned against the war. Well, how did Nixon manage to continue to fight for 4 years? Well, simple. He gave the people something. One of the most significant gifts he gave to all the hippies? He lowered the voting age. He encouraged an amendment to the Constitution that lowered the voting age from 21 to 18. Because all of the hippies were basically saying, it makes no sense that I can be drafted and go die in some rice paddy, but I can't vote. So as a result, the hippie movement completely dissipated. It went away. 1970, 1971, it was gone. All because the government gave something. Guess what the Tsar gave to the Russian people? Nothing. So it was only a matter of time. Fast forward to March 8th. On our calendar, because the Russians and us were on different calendars at that time. On the Russian calendar, it's actually February 23rd. But on that day, a sudden event occurred. See, the way things were, and again, if you think you're poor and you think you're struggling, yeah, okay. There was literally no food going into the cities. The food that they have was limited in quantity. So what the deal was the husband went to work in the factory to earn the government paper that allowed them to use that to buy whatever food was rationed. The wife would take the paper, crack it on, and go stand in food lines. And they would hope and pray that they got in the lines early enough to be able to get food for themselves, for their children. Because if they were too far back, they wouldn't get food for that day. So guess what they would have to do tomorrow? Same exact thing. Well, by March 8th on our calendar, the government stopped giving out the paper because there was little to no food to give out in forms of rations. So the workers were so angry, they walked off the job. And they went out and joined the food lines. And I don't know how any of you guys were, because we only have two gals in here, but I know how I was when I was a young man. And if someone tried cutting me in line, it was not a good thing. And that's essentially how it began. Some workers tried forcing their way in the lines because they wanted to get food, and push came to shove, and before you know it, riots start breaking out on the streets. But a weird thing happened. There were no leaders. It was spontaneous. But as things started getting out of control, when the government called in the soldiers to shoot the people, unlike 1905, the soldiers joined with the people. Which meant the government lost control. Not meaning to be political, but it's something maybe you remember. About a year or two ago, President Joe Biden, in a smug comment, basically said that, oh yeah, all those people that want to cling to their guns, what good are their guns going to do when the government can come in and use F-35s? And basically blow them up. Well, the problem for Joe Biden is that every single military guy I know would join with the Second Amendment people. So if the President of the United States was ever to deploy the military on the American citizenry, I think a similar situation could occur. The soldiers would join with the people against the politicians. And when that happens, there's no control. Oh, there we go. There's the actual date, February 23rd, on the Russian calendar. So, what do I have here? Strike erupts in St. Petersburg. Soldiers support the workers. All right, that was really good. I wish I knew those clicks were there. I got to update my notes. Apparently, I did that without updating my notes. That's not good. I look like a fool, but whatever. You can copy it down. All right, now here's the big thing. Like the 1905 revolution, when this erupted, the Tsar once again was not in the capital. Instead, this picture was actually taken on February 23rd on the Russian calendar. He was brought close to the front lines to try to boost the morale of the soldiers. But the funny thing is, the officers hand-picked soldiers who were completely loyal. So if a soldier questioned what they were doing, they were not allowed an audience with the Tsar. So look at this. This is a great little photo app. Everyone's looking happy. But the Tsar has no idea what's going on in St. Petersburg. 3 days after the capital descends into chaos, 3 days, one of the political leaders in the Russian parliament, a man by the name of Mikhail Rodzinenko, writes to the Tsar the following telegram. And they quote, "The capital is in chaos. The government is unable to act. The transport service is broken down. The food and fuel supplies are completely disorganized. There are wild shootings in the streets. It is urgent that the government take action. There must be no delay. Hesitation is fatal." Does the Tsar respond? No. His next communication came the next day, on February 27th, on Russian calendar. He sends a telegram to his wife, in which the only reference to what was going on, he says, "Again, that fat-bellied Rodzinenko has written me a load of nonsense, which I won't even bother to answer." The country is on the verge of going in flames, and the Tsar is blind. But on March 1st on the Russian calendar, because it wasn't a leap year, the Tsar did receive a telegram back from the Tsarina in which she said that the children, including the Tsar's heir, Alexei, have measles. So the Tsar doesn't do anything for a week when the capital is erupting, but he hears his kids have the measles. What does he do? He gets on his train and he orders it to race back to the capital. Well, here's the thing. When the Tsar travels, all of the soldiers know that the Tsar is traveling because they have to protect the railroad line. So a group of soldiers, real soldiers, who were fed up with what were going on, shifted the tracks and caused the train to race off the main line onto a dead-end trunk line. And when the train came to the end of the line, the soldiers surrounded it, put their guns up at the train, and were threatening to shoot the Tsar.
Give the Tsar credit. This picture was taken. He actually had the kahunas to stick his head out the window and try talking to the soldiers. This potentially could have been the last picture of the Tsar. What did the soldiers tell him? You're fired. You're out. Or we'll kill you. The Tsar met with some of his generals on the train. This was taken live. And after looking at the situation, finding out how bad the chaos got, finally listening, he agrees.
It should be Nicholas, not Nichols. I thought I fixed that last semester.
So he steps down. Now the amazing thing is, a dynasty, a ruling family that had been ruling Russia for over 300 years, the Romanov dynasty, gone. Gone. With a signature on a piece of paper that says he quits. Now, on a side note, Nicholas was allowed to return back to the capital to join with his wife, his girls, and his son. And he did attempt to flee. He first contacted his cousin Georgie, King George V of England, and begged for asylum. But in 1917, the pendulum was on Germany's side. England and France were losing. So George was worried about a socialist revolution in England. So he basically told his cousin Nicky, "Sorry, Nicky, you're not coming here." He then attempts to contact Russia, who he had been allied with since 1890. Asked again, "Can you give safe haven for me and my family?" What does France say? "We have no way to get you. Sorry. We'll come free you after the war's over." So he was trapped. Does anyone know what happened to the Tsar and his family?
They got killed, right?
They got killed. Yeah, they were, once the Bolshevists seized power, they were moved out of the capital, sent out in the country to safe houses. And the plan was to move them, at least they were told, all the way out to Vladivostok, which is one of the last cities before you get to the Pacific. In Asia. So as they were moving from safe house to safe house, a bunch of guards at one of them got drunk and decided they didn't want to have to make the drive. Too much effort. So they convinced the Tsar, his wife, his girls, and his son that they were going to go down into the basement. A truck was going to back up under the cover of the house and jump in the back for safety. Well, they take the family downstairs, line them up, telling him, "We're just going to take a picture so we can send it to the world press to show that you're still alive." They took the picture. And then when the photographer left the room, guys came in with their rifles and started going bam, 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 bam. And every single one of them fell over dead. They took the bodies, took them out in the woods, dug a shallow grave, set the bodies on fire, and buried them. Their remains were discovered 2000-ish, 2005-ish or so. And yeah, it's just a horrible tragedy. Did he deserve to die? Nope. But was he responsible for his own death? Yep. Questions? All right. So now what you have is no government. A vacuum is created. And into the vacuum would jump two separate groups, two centers of power.
both committed to basically taking control of Russia. On one hand, you had the rebels, the rioters. You had unions of soldiers and workers. Unions in Russia is Soviet. So within the capital, you had this collective referred to as the Petrograd Soviet, and the workers and the soldiers were demanding democracy. They wanted control of the government. Ironically, amongst their group was a man by the name of Leon Trotsky, if you know anything about Russian history. As far as the remnants of the old regime, well, the parliament, the Duma, was still there. So members of this body would proclaim themselves to be a provisional government, that they would take control of government temporarily, they'd make a new constitution, and they'd put a new government in. Most of the members were the top 3%, the nobles, the very wealthy bourgeoisie. And they did make promises to the people. You know, there'd be a constitution, there'd be rights, and so forth. The leader of this group was Alexander Kerensky. Kerensky was a socialist, but he wasn't a radical socialist. He believed in what's known as evolutionary socialism. So you use the government to pass laws to bring about socialism, as opposed to revolutionary socialism, which wants to destroy the government and make something new. Well, he would attempt to create a situation of something along the lines of what, well, I guess we have today, because we're not a free country anymore. We're not a capital. We've become a socialist country because the American people don't care that the government has taken away our rights. We got other things to watch, like TikTok and stuff. So, government health care, government housing, government this, government that. That's what Kerensky wanted. Now, here's the thing. Both political groups made promises to the people. They promised to give the people freedom. They promised to bring about reforms. But there was a huge problem. And I know this campus isn't exactly rocking, but by comparison, I did attend the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, the zoo. And I lived in Southwest, which is the section of campus that has the 5 22-story dorm buildings. So it's like a city. And I lived in one of the towers, John Adams. And I lived on an all-guys floor. Let me tell you one thing. You got a bunch of 18-year-olds together, first time away from home, no supervision whatsoever, and so many temptations abound. Let's just say that there was lots of shenanigans going on. Yeah, lots of tomfoolery and other type of revelry. None of which I'm going to give you any details on. But I had fun. The problem is in the chaos. You can't do things like you're supposed to do when you are in college. It's impossible to study, couldn't stay focused, so many distractions. So let's just say the first 2 years, the grades kind of went boop, 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 boop. Of course, I did recover. But it was a hard fight to get the GPA back over 3 from when it was down in the ones. But I did it. Why did that occur? Well, Mom and Dad weren't there. I was completely free to do whatever I wanted. Not that it's a direct analogy, but in Russia, the police state, the iron fist of the Tsar, was gone. So now suddenly the people had freedom to do whatever they wanted. And you know what they didn't want to do? They didn't want to fight the damn war. They didn't want to work for the government. They wanted to take care of themselves and their family. So things began to spiral out of control, descend into chaos. Even though the revolution began in March, and the Tsar was gone, actually March on the Russian calendar, all the way to November 1917, things went from bad to worse. No matter what the provisional government did, they could do nothing right. And the Petrograd Soviet only became more and more powerful. To make matters worse, they're in the middle of a war. Do you think the Germans suddenly said, oh no, we're not going to fight you anymore just because you're engaged in a revolution? The Germans continued to push in. They seized all of modern Poland. They started taking huge chunks of the Ukraine, Belarus, up in the Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Finland, all being occupied by German soldiers. At the same time, the minority groups began declaring independence. The Russian Empire began hemorrhaging states. Peasants seized the land of their nobles, hoarded food, killed people who tried coming and taking food off their tables. It was violence on a scale that Russia had never seen. And all of this chaos was because of two mistakes that the provisional government made. Two mistakes. Mistake number one, it was the provisional government that ended the police state. The police state, all of the harsh laws, all of the penalties. The provisional government said to the people, we're not going to shoot you anymore. You can have freedom of expression. You can have freedom of association. You can have freedom, 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 freedom. The Russian people had never had freedom before. And so they used it to engage in tomfoolery. I like that. Problem number two. They misread the people. They believed that the people wanted to win the war. So instead of trying to negotiate a settlement, they continued to send soldier after soldier after soldier to the front lines. But the genie was out of the bottle. The provisional government would quickly lose all control. Any of you ever see the movie Animal House? Classic, must-see movie. Must-see movie. But anyways, there's a scene at the end when there's a nice parade in the center of town that turns to chaos. And there's one of the actors, one of the characters in the movie, who's kind of a knob, who happened to be a member of ROTC. And he's trying to tell the mob to stop, stop. So he's sitting there in the uniform. He's just saying, stop, stop. But the mob doesn't listen. In the end, they end up trampling him. So just out of fun, they make him like, you know, they made it look like he got squished. Well, the provisional government gave everyone freedom. And then when the people start acting free, the provisional government comes in and starts saying, well, stop, stop, stop. But nobody listens. By summer of 1916, it's estimated that over 2 million soldiers mutinied. They actually went AWOL. They walked off the front and they went home. Things were dying quickly. Plus, on top of that, if that wasn't bad enough, in the middle of it, Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, a.k.a. Lenin, would arrive in St. Petersburg. Oh, topic for a good paper down the road for another class. How did Lenin get to St. Petersburg? Lenin was a Bolshevist, a revolutionary. He was involved in the 1905 revolution. He actually fled Russia for his life. He spent a few years in Germany, in the state of Munich, in the city of Bavaria. Wait, no, that's wrong. The state of Bavaria in the city of Munich. And he actually lived in the same neighborhood where just a few years later, none other than Adolf Hitler would live. He went to some of the same beer halls, went to some of the same music halls, literally walked in each other's footsteps. But Lenin, when the war began, fled Germany and went to Switzerland, because Switzerland was neutral. Because he was afraid, being a Russian citizen, that the Germans would shoot him as being a traitor. Well, long story short, the Tsar gets removed, the Germans get word of where Lenin is, and what do? They put him on a train, and they ship him back to Russia. And they basically tell Lenin, go cause chaos. Lenin had no initial intentions on actually winning. He just went to try to help knock Russia out of the war. So indirectly, he was a German agent. But he arrives in the middle of the chaos. He starts giving speeches, giving propaganda. And before long, the Soviets become revolutionary. And that would trigger the death knell for the provisional government. Due to Lenin's revolutionary activity, Kerensky decides he needs to do something to crush the Soviets. So in August 1917, he has a meeting with Lvov Kornilov, who was one of the last generals actually fighting in the war. He meets with Kerensky, and the two basically decide, we're going to give the soldiers representation in the government, but we need to separate the soldiers from the Soviets. So essentially what they were thinking was something like how the old Roman government during the Republic was made, where the soldiers actually had the legislative body. Well, the problem was, is how do you pull the soldiers away from the Soviets? Well, Kornilov would gather an army of, he thought, loyal troops, and he marched on St. Petersburg. The goal was to crush the Soviets. But Kerensky made a huge mistake. He doesn't tell the rest of the provisional government that Kornilov is coming to basically save the day. So the provisional government suddenly thinks this guy's coming to implement a coup d'etat and he's looking to establish a military dictatorship. So what does the provisional government do? Gave the Soviets guns. So now the Soviets that were there have guns, and now the workers have guns. And the provisional government says, join with us and fight against Kornilov. Well, unfortunately, Kornilov's troops hear the rumors of the dictatorship and they mutiny against the general. He's arrested, charged with crimes against the people, and was set for execution. Oh, I suck. Let me switch the sides. All right, here we go. Oh, all right. Well, in this chaos, this is ultimately what allowed Lenin and his close, tight-knit leadership group of Bolshevists to seize control of the Soviets. Lenin, Stalin, and Trotsky. Well, ultimately, the provisional government would be pushed over a cliff It would completely implode. And the Bolshevists would take advantage of this and would seize control of the government. Now, ironically, Trotsky, who became the propaganda minister, wrote an epic story about how the Bolshevists fought a daring battle of life and death to seize the reins of government through force and violence and bloodshed. Truth be told, when they marched on the government building on November 7th, there was only one military unit left in the city that was still working for the provisional government. A detachment of the Women's Guard. And the ladies tried fighting, but no offense to the two ladies here, the average guy is a lot stronger than the average girl. And the Bolshevists kind of, let's just say, made the ladies realize they were on the wrong side. So once that resistance was beat, here's the extent of their takeover. Nice comfy chair. They literally walked into the offices and just sat down. Started going through the drawers and look, I'm now the government. Lenin then would proclaim the creation of a Soviet democracy. A democracy of the workers and the peasants. The hammer and the sickle. I've already mentioned what happened to Nicholas and his family. Well, the other thing that he did is he reached out to Germany and he pulled Russia out of the war. So, contacts Germany. They sit down beginning in November all the way, I think it went until February 1918, and they would hammer out what became known as the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. Why the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk? Well, there's the village or town of Brest-Litovsk. That's where the Russians sat down with the Germans and they negotiated the treaty. And what did they give them? Finland, plus Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Belarus, all of the Ukraine. They turned over to the Germans, what statistically here says 25% of the Russian population, 25% of the railroad lines, 35% of the grain producing area, 70% of the industry, 26% of iron, 89% of coal mines. To get out of the war, Lenin gave the Germans whatever they wanted. But the war came to an end. But then another war started. Because nobody elected the Bolshevists. The Bolshevists took over. Well, all throughout Russia, there were people that were loyal to the provisional government. And in 1918, just as Russia leaves one war, a civil war erupts that pits the white Russians against the red Russians. It was one of the most destructive wars in history. Russia would suffer another 20 million casualties in the 3 years of the war, culminating in 1921 with a Soviet victory. And upon achieving that victory, upon conquering all of the other territories that attempted to break away, Lenin would proclaim a new state, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the USSR, the bad guys of my youth, the Reds. This would bring an end to the Eastern Front. questions? All right, well, let's fast forward back to the West. Well, we're going to skip over 1917. We're going to go right to the end of the story, 1918. Because by 1918, it's clear to the German officials that they can't win. So what ends up happening? Well, November 9th, 1918, the Tsar, Wilhelm, although I have the English name up there, William II, abdicated. He quit. A new republic was created, and power was transferred from the crown to a provisional government that would make a constitution and protect the rights of the people. Then, just 2 days later, 11-11-11, at 11 a.m. on the 11th day of the 11th month, in the fourth year of the war, the shots came to an end. An armistice was signed in Compiègne Forest in Picardy in France. What's armistice? What does the word armistice mean?
It's like guns?
No. An armistice is not a surrender. An armistice is a ceasefire. Both sides agreed to stop shooting at each other. Now, FYI, Germany had enough men and munitions to have the war go into 1919. They had not lost. They began losing ground, though. So they decided to agree to a ceasefire to attempt to negotiate. But the terms of the armistice were shockingly harsh. All of the land that Germany still occupied, parts of France, parts of Belgium, Luxembourg, Alsace and Lorraine, all had to be abandoned. All of the hundreds of thousands and millions of German soldiers had to be brought all the way back to Germany. They had to turn over all their weapons of war. All their battleships, their submarines, their big artillery guns, locomotives. They had to free all the prisoners of war. And even more insulting, they had to renounce the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. All that Lenin had given them, they had to say, we don't want it anymore. That's what the Allies demanded of Germany to get an armistice. And Germany decided to agree. But let's not think Germany was defeated. The end of World War I was not the end of World War II. With Russia out of the war, Germany was able to move all of its strength to the Western Front. And the Germans had larger armies than any one of the three major allies that had troops in France. But Germany's allies crumbled. The Ottomans would be knocked out of the war, as would the Austrian, Austro-Hungarians. So, in November 1918, it was Germany fighting alone. So then why did they agree to this? Words. It was words that got him to agree to it. January 1917, The president of these United States, Woodrow Wilson, in his State of the Union address, decides to send word to the German people, not the German government, but the German people. And he said the following, and I quote, "We have no jealousy of German greatness. We grudge her no achievement of learning or of pacific enterprise. Such has made her record very bright and very enviable. We do not wish to injure her or to block in any way her legitimate influence of power. We do not wish to fight her either with arms or with hostile arrangements of force. If she's willing to associate herself with us and other peace-loving nations of the world in covenants of justice and law and fair dealing, we wish her only to accept a place of equality amongst the peoples of the world, the new world in which we now live, instead of a position of mastery." This line, and this is going to be the last little bit, we'll get out a couple of minutes early, was part of a presentation in which he would develop what became known as Wilson's 14 points. These would be the four major principles upon which he wanted to see the post-World War built upon. The first five, and I have it broken down that way. No, I don't. The first five, all types of diplomacy, diplomatic words. So, for instance, all of the peace agreements had to be open and transparent. No secret deals. They had to be freedom of the seas. You know, no trade barriers. Arms levels had to be reduced. Colonial claims had to be settled fairly. Points 6 through 13, he got specific. He talked about border readjustments. Basically, he believed in what was called self-determination, that people should have a right to control their own destiny. But I'm not going to make you worry about that, because a lot of it had to do with dealing with the Austro-Hungarian Empire, now that it had broken apart. But this is the last point, and this will be the last click of the day. To Wilson, the most important point was the 14th point, in which he called for the creation of a new government body, which he labeled it as being the League of Nations. To preserve peace, to make this war the war to end all wars, he wanted this global body in which all nations could send delegates to serve as a forum for interactivity and diplomacy, a way that would force the nations to look each other in the eye and talk to one another, to achieve diplomatic solutions instead of warfare. He was terrified that if Germany is punished, they will seek revenge and there'll be another war. So he believed by having this forum, it would give all nations a chance to air their grievances, and all of the other nations could collectively come up with solutions. Thus, peace will be achieved. But here's what we're going to see when we come back on Thursday. Do you think any of the world leaders that had been leading their nations for the entirety of the war cared about what the President of the United States had to say, considering the United States didn't join the war until April of 1917? Well, we're going to see what they wanted when we come back. Papers are due Friday. At this point, you should be almost done. Don't forget, you're going to drop them in Engage. And when you drop them in Engage, make sure you click the two buttons acknowledging it's the final draft. All right?